From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A health expert says there's no real reason to scrap the current health care plan.
The Affordable Care Act could absolutely be repaired and improved if we could achieve some bipartisan political consensus in Washington.
But it's still got that Obamacare name. The state legislature is expected to end pensions and switch to a 401k type plan for teachers.
We've got this huge pension debt that we're passing on to our kids, and it just simply doesn't work anymore.
One state rep says the Speaker pro tem is violating House rules and the Constitution by ignoring pleas for a roll call vote.
We wanted people to be on record to say, no, we shouldn't have more money for Meals on Wheels, or no, we shouldn't have more money for seniors.
And research shows term limits mean short-term thinking.
Anything that's really tough, they can kick the can down the road, and then the next batch of people have to cope with it.
That's a lot of political stories. But hey, we've got a cocktail for you, too. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Later in the program, we'll talk with a researcher who has been looking at the impact that term limits on state legislators have had on Michigan politics and policy. We'll also hear from a House member who says the Republicans are violating the state constitution, and a priest who served the needy in Detroit gets a step forward to sainthood. But first, as you probably heard, the U.S. House approved a new health care plan designed by the Republicans to replace Obamacare. Michigan Republican members of Congress were united in the condemnation of Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act. Representative John Molinar says he voted for the new plan to, quote, rescue Americans from the collapsing health care law. Representative Paul Mitchell said the Affordable Care Act continues to collapse. Families continue to struggle. Representative Dave Trott said the voters make it clear they want to see a new direction for our nation's health care system. And Representative Tim Walberg said Obamacare is on the brink of collapse and has failed to live up to its many promises. Well, here to talk about the issues of Obamacare and what the new American Health Care Act does and does not do is John Agyanian. He's the director of the Institute for Health Policy and Innovation at the University of Michigan. Let's start with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. We've heard from small businesses that the premiums are skyrocketing and some states' insurance companies are pulling out. Is it broken? What's happening to Obamacare?
So the Affordable Care Act has done a lot of good over the past several years, expanding coverage to about 24 million Americans, and in many parts of the country, helping to bring people into the health insurance system that were priced out of it before, either through expanded Medicaid coverage like we've had here in Michigan, the Healthy Michigan Plan, or through subsidized coverage under the exchanges or the marketplaces to allow individuals and small businesses to get coverage. What we see now is that in some states, those marketplaces are struggling. Premiums are rising substantially and insurers are pulling out. And so they're not functioning well as markets. In other parts of the country, they're functioning quite well. So it's hard to say that across the board, the Affordable Care Act is failing or succeeding when we really have to look within states and individual markets to understand how it's working.
I think part of the resistance is probably because a lot of people don't like the idea of government mandating they do anything. Could the Affordable Care Act be fixed, tweaked, or does it have to be scrapped, as the Republicans say?
The Affordable Care Act could absolutely be repaired and improved if we could achieve some bipartisan political consensus in Washington. In those markets where prices are rising too quickly or insurers are pulling out, there are constructive steps that Congress could take and the Department of Health and Human Services and the federal government could take to shore up those markets while preserving the successes in other parts of the country. We've also seen that the Medicaid expansion here in Michigan, as well as in 30 other states in the District of Columbia, has generally been well accepted. And it's allowed many people who were priced out of the insurance market and access to affordable health care to gain coverage, particularly adults with incomes under $16,000 a year. So there's definitely opportunity to improve the Affordable Care Act. The American Health Care Act, I think, has raised some serious issues that will be difficult to address going forward in a bipartisan way.
We'll get to that in just a second, but I wanted to find out, you did some research about how Obamacare was doing in Michigan. What has it done for the state?
Well, and particularly we focused on the Healthy Michigan Plan in partnership with the Michigan Department of Health.
That's the Medicaid expansion.
The Medicaid expansion, that's right. And it's expanded coverage to about 650,000 adults in Michigan between ages 18 and 64. So it's really had an important impact on access to care and reducing the financial stress that goes with being uninsured for Michigan adults. What we've seen is, for example, uncompensated care, charity care that hospitals provide to people who can't pay their bills has gone down by nearly half in the first 2 years of the Affordable Care Act. And so that has really helped the financial position of Michigan hospitals and community health centers, particularly those that serve large numbers of low-income adults. And when those hospitals and health centers are doing better, they can provide better services to everyone in their community. So that's an important step forward. We've also seen that the people who've gained coverage report they're less worried about paying medical bills or going bankrupt because of their medical care, that they can access care more effectively, and they're beginning to use preventive services and primary care. And we've also begun to see that about half of those covered by the Medicaid expansion are working, and another quarter are looking for work. And many of them report that they're able to do a better job at work or look for a better job because they're more secure in their health care.
Let's turn to the Republican plan, the American Health Care Act. President Trump says it's a great plan. It doesn't mandate coverage. Instead of subsidies, it provides a refundable tax credit based on age and income. States would be able to get waivers from covering essential health benefits and waivers to let insurers charge consumers more if they have pre-existing conditions, which, as I understand it, is defined as anything from diabetes to sexual assault or a C-section. It also caps Medicaid coverage on a per-person basis. So who's going to be better off under this plan and who's not?
What we've seen from the Congressional Budget Office that evaluated the original proposal that came out a couple months ago, and we're now waiting for their updated assessment of the new bill that was passed in the House this week. What they reported was that younger, healthier, and more wealthy adults would potentially see their costs of insurance coverage go down, but that older, sicker, and less wealthy adults, particularly those over age 50 with chronic conditions and lower incomes, they could see their costs of health insurance and out-of-pocket spending for medical care go up substantially on the order of $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 per year.
Wow. The Senate is promising substantial changes. Do we have any idea what that might mean?
It's going to be very important to see how this takes shape over the coming weeks. We're waiting for that Congressional Budget Office score or evaluation in terms of what impact this bill will have on the federal budget and the number of people potentially losing coverage. The original bill 2 months ago was estimated to cause 24 million Americans to lose coverage over the next 10 years, basically erasing the gains that we've seen under the Affordable Care Act. There's also a provision in the Senate called the Byrd Rule, which for bills like this that can pass the House with a simple majority, in the Senate, only provisions that relate to the federal budget, either spending or revenue, can be passed with a simple majority in the Senate. And the Republicans have a 52-vote majority in the 100-vote Senate. Anything that is not directly related to the budget will generally require 60 votes, which means 8 Democratic senators would need to go along. And many of the provisions in this bill passed by the House this week may not meet that Byrd Rule because they don't directly relate to the budget. Things like allowing insurers to charge higher premiums for older or sicker adults, that may not meet that Byrd Rule provision.
So we'll need those 60 votes, which means the Democrats get a say.
They certainly get a say in those provisions. So there are other pieces, for example, changes to the Medicaid program and cutting back on about $880 billion of Medicaid funding over the next decade. That potentially could pass with a simple majority in the Senate. But many Republican senators as well as Republican governors have raised substantial concerns about what that would mean for people in their states who've gained coverage over the past 3 years.
John Ionian is the director of the Institute of Healthcare Policy and Innovation at the University of Michigan. He's also a professor of internal medicine and of public health and public policy. Thanks for coming in and explaining this to us because I haven't heard anybody else do that good of a job yet.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Hey, later on All Things Considered, there's going to be a story about the 27th Amendment to the Constitution. Now, if you're not a constitutional scholar, we'll tell you what the amendment dealt with in a moment. The key here is Michigan had a significant role in the history of the 27th Amendment. Michigan put it over the top in 1992. And you know who was there to witness it? Rick Pluta. Michigan Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. So, Mr. Pluta, why don't you set the scene for us?
Sure. Yeah, it was 1992, and that there was this spate of states that had adopted the Madison Amendment, and it was getting very, very, very close. So this resolution had already passed the Senate. And the House was sort of like, we'll get to it when we get to it. When word came down that the New Jersey Assembly was getting ready to take it up that afternoon. And so then it became a race to be the state that adopted the most recent amendment to the United States Constitution. And so here we have on the floor of the State House a Republican, State Representative Bill Martin, who's introducing the resolution and explaining what's going on.
The first state to ratify this amendment was Maryland, December 19th, 1789. Now, it can be said that James Madison was probably not real effective, but he's at least persistent. Here we are today, really with a historical moment. The state of Michigan has the opportunity, with the passage of this resolution, to ratify, being the ratifying state of this constitutional amendment.
So what does the 27th Amendment require? What's the Madison Amendment require?
Okay, well, it was proposed by James Madison, the father of the Constitution. It was supposed to be one of the first amendments in the Bill of Rights, but the states never adopted it. And there was no time limit for doing it, which is why this was allowed to linger on for so long. And what it says is that Congress, members of Congress, cannot collect a pay raise that they voted on for themselves until an election has intervened, that they have to face the voters before they get the pay raise that they voted on for themselves.
So this was going on. Different states were taking it up. What prompted these states to suddenly look at the Madison Amendment after more than 200 years?
Well, as we'll hear later on this afternoon on All Things Considered, it was an undergraduate student in Texas who got a bad grade on a paper explaining how the Madison Amendment might be adopted. The instructor just said it really didn't sound very reasonable, and so he set about proving that it could happen. So states started falling into line, and then as more and more states fell into line, the momentum picked up the faster it was happening. And so then, at the very end, it became a race to be the state that was going to put it over the top.
I hope that student is a teacher now. That's Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio's Capitol reporter and keeper of the history, because, you know, he's that old. Thanks, Rick.
Sure. Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Democrats in Lansing want what they call a voting bill of rights. That means no reason absentee voting, early in-person voting, registering up to 15 days before an election, and other things that make it easier for people to vote. Republicans have in the past offered bills for stricter voter identification laws. Joining me to talk about that are Joe Hoffman, a former Republican state representative from Holland. He served as the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. And Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Joe, with the low voter turnout we often see, why not make voting more convenient?
I have no problem of trying to make it more convenient as long as we can make sure that we have the safeguards in place that we deter against fraud and people voting more than once or people voting for others. As long as those safeguards are in place, I don't have a big problem with open absentee ballot. It's been proposed in the past by the Republican side. But it is interesting that early voting turnout, election officials say it doesn't increase turnout.
You mentioned fraud, and that's brought up a lot, but there's almost no evidence that that's an issue in Michigan.
I think we saw in the last election in some of the Detroit precincts that things did not match up.
Well,
I'm not sure that's true. I don't believe we have a lot of fraud here in West Michigan and Ottawa County.
The audit by the Secretary of State's office didn't find any fraud involved. A lot of mistakes, but not fraud. Vicki, what are your thoughts about the call for stricter voter ID laws versus this voting rights bill proposed by the Democrats?
Well, I support the voting rights bills proposed by the Democrats, and so do most county and local clerks. This has been something that the Clerks Association has been looking for a long time, to make it much easier for people to vote, to have early voting, and especially no reason absentee. The question here is, do we do it by constitutional amendment, or do we do it by law? Right now, they're proposing a constitutional amendment, which will require 2/3 vote in the House and 2/3 vote in the Senate in order to get it on the ballot. I think that is a really long haul and a hard way to go. Whereas if you do it as legislation, it's 50% plus one in the House and in the Senate. It's time that at least we open up the voting to no reason absentee. We're making it very difficult for people to vote. They don't know if they're going to end up in the hospital on Tuesday election day in the emergency room and not be able to vote. There's no reason why we don't allow people to vote by no reason absentee and register people automatically at the Secretary of State's office.
I think Vicki and I are closer than you may believe on the open absentee. I think we can get there. I have personally a problem with early voting to extend it over a 2-3 week period. And I think the last election kind of shows that late news actually made the difference in the last election. And I don't think people should be voting 2-3 weeks in advance without having the whole picture.
Let's look at another issue. The legislature is considering ending pension benefits under the Michigan Public School Employees Retirement System for newly hired teachers and instead offer a kind of a 401k-type retirement savings plan. Joe, what's the reasoning behind this proposal?
Frankly, we can't afford it anymore. We've got about $8 to $11 billion in local pension liabilities. We're underfunded. And we've been underfunded for years, but it's time to recognize that with Michigan not being a growing state, and it hasn't been for decades, the calculations that they've used in the past on return on investment for these things haven't kept up with reality. And we've got this huge pension debt that we're passing on to our kids. So we've got to figure out a way to get ourselves out of the pension game, to live up to our obligations for those that have been employees of local and state that are guaranteed in the Constitution. But long term, we have to get ourselves out of this.
You're right on your figure about $11 billion for local governments, but the Michigan Public School Employees Retirement System is underfunded by about $26 billion. Vicki, should pensions end and a 401k-type plan be substituted?
I don't think so. And I think especially when you come to local governments, it's a local control issue. And it's also a talent issue. We need to draw on the best talent possible, and sometimes that means really some robust payoff at the end for retirement in exchange for a lower paycheck during the working years. But let's talk about MPSRS for a moment, which is the Michigan Public School Employee Retirement System, because this is what they're talking about right now in the legislature, shutting it down. The original plan for years and years and years was fully funded, and it was basically something that teachers paid into and the schools matched, and it replaced 45% of pre-retirement income. That was it, just 45%. So it wasn't a huge pension plan. And for custodial employees and bus drivers and lower paid workers, it could amount to about $1,200 a month or less. But what's happened since we went to Proposal A and opened up charter schools is we keep taking people and students out of the equation, leaving only the unionized employees to cover the total cost of all of the other retirees that are no longer having people pay into the plan due to privatization, charter school growth, and the growth of non-union schools. So this is really the problem, and that's called not using business practices in government. In private sector, if you are part of an employee plan where there are multiple employers, like a bunch of different school districts, and you want to stop paying into the plan, you have to write a big check to cover all of your retirees so that you don't leave the plan holding the bag for them. That's called withdrawal liability, and that's part of federal law. It does not apply to these government plans, and if the Republicans in the legislature were so convinced that we should run government like a business, then they would tell the schools that privatize and the charter schools they have to pay up for the retirees that are currently in that district so that we don't have a shortfall like we have now. This isn't about population growth, and it isn't about a whole lot of other things. It's about the failure of the government to control for these withdrawals from the plan and privatization, which leaves everybody else stuck holding the bag for the retirees from that district.
Joe, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that.
We're not going to charge the charters. The reason charters are working is because we didn't put them into that archaic MPSRS pension plan. they operate the way most businesses do run today in a 401k system. That money that people put in themselves is mobile, it's portable, and if you don't make a career out of teaching, if you go and do something else, you take that money with you. Vicki, I respect your opinion, but I think you're living in kind of a fantasy world of going back to the old days of that pension system being fully funded. And that's really what we're trying to get away from, trying to come up to the way people work in today's world. And that's a 401k system.
And I think that's a pretty good illustration of the divide at the legislature as well. That's Joe Havemann. He's a former Republican legislator who served as the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. We also heard from Vicki Barnett, former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Hey, both you guys have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Like most journalists, I follow a lot of legislators on social media outlets. I noticed not too long ago, earlier this week actually, on Facebook, that Representative Andy Schorr, a Democrat from Lansing, went on a bit of a rant. He accused the Republican Speaker pro tempore, Lee Chatfield, of violating the rules of the House and the state's constitution. Well, Representative Schorr joins us now. What was happening on the floor of the House that got you all riled up?
Well, first, let me say I have nothing but respect for our Speaker pro tem, Lee Chatfield. He's a very nice guy. We get along. But the issue was we were doing our budget. Democrats were offering up amendments, as we do, trying to make it better. We thought that issues like funding for Meals on Wheels and our roads and our seniors and others should have a little bit more of a priority in the budget. And every once in a while, when we offer amendments, we ask for a record roll call vote on the amendment. According to the House rules and the Constitution, if one-fifth of the body requests a record roll call vote, it has to be granted. So we had members who would offer it. The rest of us would stand up and yell support, because under the rules of the House, if you have a fifth of the body that says support, they are supposed to put it up for a roll call vote. So we did this, and the Speaker pro tem chose not to notice. So he makes a ruling based on his perception of the House, and he says there is not support. We had easily 35 people standing up yelling support, and he was choosing not to notice. Our floor leader challenged the ruling of the chair, which, again, under our procedures, she can do. He says, I don't think there's enough support. She says, I challenge the ruling of the chair, and under the rules, we're supposed to vote on that. We're supposed to vote, do we uphold the ruling of the chair, or do we not uphold the ruling of the chair? And he wouldn't do that, which is a violation of the rules. So this happened a number of times, and then finally we handed in a document signed by 35 people, which is more than one-fifth of the members of the House, asking for a record roll call vote on an amendment. And that document, even though it was handed in, they refused to acknowledge it. So my rant, as you say on Facebook, you know, was mostly that they've got 63 members. They need 55 votes to pass something. They've got 63 members. If an amendment goes up, they can defeat it. They have the majority. The Republicans are in the majority. The citizens have voted them the majority. And that's something I don't love, but I respect. I respect the will of the citizens.
Isn't that one of the points, though? I mean, if the Republicans have the majority, the result was going to be the same regardless. So why does it matter? Why did you want this rule call?
Because we wanted to be on record. We wanted people to be on record to say, no, we shouldn't have more money for Meals on Wheels, or no, we shouldn't have more money for seniors. If that's what they believe in their budget that they put up and passed, then if we're going to put up amendments, we should be able to get a vote on it. They should have to actually put their money where their mouth is and say, no, we don't think there should be more for this. And then they can explain why. I'm sure they've got their reasons, and that's okay. But the Constitution and the rules of the House allow for roll call votes, things that are in the record so people can know. When I put that on Facebook, you probably saw the comments. I had people who were saying, well, where was my rep on this? Where was my rep on this? And the answer is, I can't tell you, because leadership basically refused to allow the people to know where their rep is. Again, they're going to win the vote. They've got the majority. But to not at least allow for a roll call vote for the citizens to know where their members are on these individual issues, to me, that's wrong, but it is also a violation of the rules that we have all passed and the Constitution and Mason's rules. So I wasn't upset about losing on the issue because we were going to lose. I was upset that the process was violated. And, you know, if you look at the Senate, when they did their budget, they gave roll call votes and they voted them down. And in the past, the House has given roll call votes. But, you know, the folks in charge now have decided that they're not going to allow for that. And they're going to, in essence, not even allow for the minority party to challenge. In our system of democracy, you have rights of the minority. We have rights to put things up for amendment, to ask for roll call votes. We don't have rights to win the vote because the citizens haven't elected us the majority, but we have rights to have things taken up. That didn't happen. So I was pretty frustrated. Like I said, I have tremendous respect for the Speaker pro tem, for the Speaker, and for any of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle.
We got that, but I want to talk about that because I believe this maneuver by the Speaker pro tem is referred to as quick gavel. This is something the Democrats did when they were in the majority. If it was okay then, why is it not okay now?
You know what? I've been serving for 5 years. I've never been in the majority. I can't tell you what they did 6 years ago. If I were in the majority, I wouldn't do it that way. It's called a fast gavel. If I were in the majority, I wouldn't do it that way. If they did, then it was wrong then, but we're not in majority, and I haven't been in my 5 years there. You want to tell me things that were bad in the past? Fine, then I'll tell you what was wrong. If the Democrats did it in the past, it was wrong then, and it's wrong now. You know, I tell my kids, just because someone else did something bad doesn't mean you should do it and say it's okay.
I understand the Democrats filed a lawsuit challenging this practice of the Speaker pro tem, ignoring the call for roll call votes. The appeals court basically said it's not the court's place to tell the House how to follow its rules, which to me kind of sounds like a dodge. But what more can be done?
Not much. Citizens can be upset and choose to vote for other representatives. You know, we can take it to the courts again, but it's what you said. The appeals court said due to separation of powers, we're not going to involve ourselves in whether the rules were followed or not. I would think that if the rules weren't followed, if the rules were violated, then the courts would, in essence, invalidate the actions that were taken after the rules were not followed. But I'm not a judge on the appeals court, nor am I a justice of the Supreme Court who refused to take that up on appeal.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but if it's in the Constitution, I think there would be a question there as well. I just want to make a note here. We wanted to know how Speaker pro tempore Lee Chatfield counts the vote. His office declined our request for an interview today. So I just want to thank you, Representative Shore, for calling in. Representative Andy Shore represents the 68th District in the Michigan House. Thanks for the time.
Great. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Pope Francis has elevated a Michigan priest another step closer to sainthood. The Pope announced that Father Solanus Casey, a member of the Capuchin Franciscan Order of St. Joseph in Detroit and one of the co-founders of the city's Capuchin Soup Kitchen, has been elevated from venerable to blessed by the Roman Catholic Church. Joining us to talk about this is Father Larry Weber. You should assume that a lot of us are not Catholic as you explain what's happening here. So let's start with the announcement. What's the difference between being venerable to being blessed?
In the Roman Catholic tradition, we all want to be saints. We all want to be in heaven with God. So what's happened with the step of beatification means that the church basically makes a pronouncement that there is evidence from God through a sign that has been given, that goes through a very difficult process of investigation, a miracle, that this soul is in heaven with God. We know that for sure, and that God is pleased with this soul, and that this allows this soul to intercede, you know, becomes a helper to others in their relationship with God.
So who was Solanus Casey?
So Solanus Casey was a Capuchin priest, a member of the Franciscan family. He was from Wisconsin originally, and he felt called to the Capuchin way of life. So he came to Detroit, began his Capuchin life here at St. Bonaventure Monastery. And he was ordained in a limited way. He was an Irishman. His parents were from Ireland, from an immigrant family. So he was stationed out in New York, wasn't allowed to preach or hear confessions, and they put him on the door as the friar who would answer the door. And people who came to the door suddenly realized the holiness of this man. Eventually, the superiors moved him to Detroit because this is where the superiors were, and they wanted to keep an eye on him. 2 weeks after he came, the front office business had gone from about 20 people a day to about 200. He had this incredible ability to listen to people. He also had an ability to read souls, and he was also known for healings. Tens of thousands visit his tomb here at the Solanus Center.
Which gets us to the performed miracle, the first performed miracle. What was it?
There was this person praying at the tomb here in Detroit, and she had this long list of people she was praying for. She didn't know anything about Father Solanus, by the way. It was her first visit here to the center. Someone had brought her here, and she was asking what all these prayer things were on the tomb. People write out their prayer petitions and leave them on the tomb. And so she started making her list of everyone she was praying for. She was kneeling down, and when she was ready to get up, she heard this inner voice, very strong inner voice, say to her, "But what about you? What do you need?" She had been born with an incurable skin disease. So she prayed for that, and she felt something happening in her body, and within an hour, she was cured of it. Never came back.
What has to happen to elevate Father Casey to sainthood?
we now collect a new favor that has to happen after the Holy Father signed this decree, and it has to go through the same process. So this miracle that was approved was about 5 years ago, because it goes through about five different courts of doctors. So that's what we need for sainthood. But now we just need another favor to be declared by Roma Miracle.
How common is it that someone from the United States becomes a saint?
There are like five women born in the United States who are saints. There are no men born in the United States who are saints. There is the first blessed to be born in the United States, male, is a priest, a diocesan priest from Nebraska, who will be beatified in September. He was a martyr, so he needed no miracle. Father Solanas is the first U.S. male, first to be declared venerable by the Roman Catholic Church. He will be the first U.S.-born male to be beatified who's not a martyr.
That's Father Larry Weber. We've been talking about the Roman Catholic Church elevating Father Solanas Casey, who served in Detroit, to blessed, a step closer to sainthood. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. God bless.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Voters still love the idea of term limits. The idea of throw the rascals out after a few terms is supposed to end career politicians and instead give us a citizen legislator who is more connected with the people back home. A new book explains 13 years of research into how term limits have worked in Michigan. Its title is Implementing Term Limits, The Case of the Michigan Legislature. It was written by Marjorie Sarbaugh-Thompson, and like Thompson, Marjorie joins us now. Let's look at some of the claims proponents of term limits made back in the day, starting with that idea that citizen legislators would be more interested in the common good than self-interest, as you wrote. What did your research show as Michigan transitioned to an all-term-limited lawmaker body?
One of the things that we found is that when people have a short time horizon and they don't have much experience, for one thing, they concentrate on things that they can fix easily and quickly. And for another thing, they have to try and figure out where to get information on how to do that. One of the main winners out of term limits has been lobbyists and special interest groups. One of the big losers that we discovered has been key local officials and also more experienced colleagues within the chamber. So even though voters were promised that term limits would sever the cozy ties between legislators and lobbyists, what we actually found is that legislators are more likely to turn to lobbyists for information.
I want to get into that a little further, but you talk about ambitious people. I mean, generally speaking, we like ambitious people. You don't want a bunch of slackers leading the state, right? But how does that change their priorities once they're in office?
What we discovered was that the biggest change in the people who are elected to office is that they are much more politically ambitious than they were prior to term limits. With really short limits, and Michigan has the shortest limits on its lower chamber of any state in the entire country, with really short limits, people come into office thinking about what they're going to do next. So they come into office with a plan for the next political position they're going to seek.
Right, because if they go into the House, at best they've got a 6-year tenure there and they're out.
Right.
Whereas before, you might go into the House of Representatives and say, this is where I belong and this is where I can serve the people best. At least that's the hope. And that's not an option any longer.
Right. No, it's not. And so people immediately are trying to jockey for position so that they have things they can run on for their next position, and they want to avoid anything that might be damaging to them when they run for the next position.
So they're not risk takers and they want to make a big splash.
Absolutely. And they want to concentrate on things that are quick fixes, easy to do. Anything that's really tough, they can kick the can down the road and then the next batch of people have to cope with it.
It was argued that career politicians before term limits got too cozy with lobbyists. You just mentioned that might not be the case. Since term limits have been fully implemented, just how has that relationship between legislators and lobbyists and special interests changed?
Well, one of the things that we discovered is that interest groups are becoming more active in recruiting candidates to run for office. So people actually arrive in Lansing with cozy ties to special interests already established, because one of the big impediments to running for office is that it can be expensive, especially if it's a competitive race. Some of the costs of running for a state house seat, which doesn't, you know, it pays like around $70,000 a year, some of those elections can cost as much as $500,000. And so people don't want to run for those offices unless they're sure that they have some money behind them. So interest groups can offer them money and recruit them. And then when they arrive in Lansing, they already have that relationship.
So you're saying an environmental group or a business group might recruit before the parties would recruit them, just so they have a stake in the game?
Absolutely.
The book indicates change to term-limited legislators has also had an effect on the gender makeup of the legislature. In what way?
For one brief time period, there were only four Republican women in Lansing. Republican women were actually doing fairly well. There's a little bit more of a tilt toward women in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party, at least prior to term limits. After term limits, Republican women really took it on the chin in Michigan. Democratic women have managed to kind of hold their own, but Republican women almost became an endangered species. And part of that is that they have been reluctant to run for office than they were prior to term limits.
Why?
I'm not sure why. I would want to ask them. But I suspect it may have something to do with the kinds of competition, who's recruiting, you know, what they see as their actual prospects of having a longer term impact.
With these citizen legislators who are supposed to have closer ties to the folks back home, you note that the voters actually have less influence rather than more influence on legislators voting. Why is that?
Well, one of the things that we found really startling was that there actually were more changes in the Senate than in the House in terms of information gathering. And in the Senate, prior to term limits, there were a lot of senators who said that when they had a problem and they wanted some information on how something would actually work, they were trying to make up their mind about how to vote on the floor on something, they would turn to key local officials. And some of the people, particularly Senate districts can be pretty large when we get to outstate areas and rural areas. Some of the people had as many as 35 school superintendents in their districts. The preterm limit senators were utterly amazing, as were the preterm limit House members, I would add. They could tell you the names of those superintendents. And they could tell you which one they would call on a particular type of issue that might affect school funding or school policies so that they could find out boots on the ground, what is this going to do in your rural school district? And that is, we think, a really big loss for voters because those are the folks who are close and in touch with them, those local officials.
So is this a matter of just not having time to build those relationships?
I would suspect so. I would also suspect that probably there's a different style of campaigning because there's a lot more money flooding in. But I think, you know, if you're only going to be there for a short amount of time, it's difficult to get around to all the school board meetings or all the community, you know, council meetings and really meet some of those people.
As the two of you wrote, access to elected officials matters in making policy. So I think I know the answer now based on what you've said before, but who has better access to politicians now?
The lobbyists.
What about the bureaucrats? Because yes, the lobbyists have institutional knowledge as well, but the bureaucrats, the state agency heads and their staff have institutional knowledge. Has anything changed between preterm limits and post-term limits with the relationship to government agencies, directors, and staff?
Yes, that relationship has made some gains as well. And that may be somewhat reassuring if you're talking about the career civil servants, but state agency officials also include political appointees. And with term limits on the governor's office, you can end up with some fairly short-term people as directors of state agencies. And some of the time, it's not clear that those are merit-based positions as much as appointee patronage kinds of positions. So without going further in depth and figuring out whether it's the civil servants who are gaining more access or whether it's the political appointees, it's hard to know what really is happening there.
I guess the other thing, the legislature is supposed to be a watchdog over the agencies to make sure that they're doing things properly. If the legislators are more dependent on information from the agencies, that could be problematic as well.
One of the things we discovered when we were doing the term limits interviews is that a lot of state legislators do not realize that they have an oversight or monitoring role with respect to the state agencies. We had people who told us that we didn't understand the nature of government, that the state agency officials were accountable to the governor and that they had no authority to supervise them, which, if you remember your introductory American government class, it applies at the state level as well, and they clearly are supposed to exercise oversight. So we learned to adopt sort of a poker face when we heard that.
The first time you had to be astonished, though, I assume.
Yeah, a little bit.
There's a lot more churn in membership in the legislature because of term limits, not the entrenched politicians that were a big concern to people who supported implementing term limits. But how do term limits affect actual competition for the seats? We've got people up for election, new people up for election more often. Does that mean a lot more people, a lot better people have access or not?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that because you have to think back to the primary elections because so many seats are really heavily gerrymandered in Michigan. And in fact, we point out in the book that there is a district in which some of the Tigers baseball stars can hit a baseball further than that because the distance connecting the two chunks of the district is smaller than that between home plate and the outfield fence in Comerica
Park. Sure, the width of a street sometimes.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about winning that, whoever has the majority party label behind their name is almost the assured winner. Sometimes the November elections are more of a coronation than a competition. So a lot of the real competition happens in the primaries. And what we found was that there were fewer contested primaries in competitive districts after term limits. That is, people are being screened out so that you don't waste time and bloody your candidates in the primary. In the really safe districts that are a foregone conclusion which party is going to win, sometimes we found as many as 17 candidates running. So at that point, you've split the electorate and sliced and diced it so finely that a very, very small faction is choosing a candidate in a primary, sometimes by 100 votes or so, and then that person is really entering a coronation in November. So it's a lot more complicated than just saying, oh, we have more candidates. As you get rid of incumbents, there's more competition. You have new faces, but it's not clear that it's a competitive election.
Before term limits, some legislators nationally became experts in certain areas. I mean, they were around for a while. They might get to know the budget process really well, or they might be an expert on conservation or civil rights. Other members consulted them. They respected them. They listened to them. How does that work when often legislators are not in office long enough to become an expert in much of anything?
Well, it's much harder for people to figure out whose information they should rely on, who are the honest brokers. When we interviewed the pre-term limits legislators, they could tell you which colleague they would go to, and they would say, this is somebody who will tell me both sides and will say, for your district, you should probably vote this way, but I'm going to vote this way either because of my particular preferences or because of my district. And so you had a lot of people who had a reputation for being extremely knowledgeable and extremely honest brokers. That's what we call in the book informal influence. And in terms of the power dynamics, the influence dynamics within the chamber, informal influence goes way, way down after term limits. Your power comes from whatever position you hold. The leadership becomes much more powerful, but the people who were not in a formal position, but who just were knowledgeable, and particularly it was important that they were trustworthy, honest brokers, that has really shrunk a lot.
I'd kind of like you to summarize what you found in your study of Michigan term limits. I mean, telling us whether citizens of the state are now better served or not better served by term-limited legislators. I mean, I understand where the book landed, but I'd like you to give us a summary.
Well, I think one thing that might be helpful for people who are not political junkies like I am, a way to think about it would be to think about having grandparents or a really doting aunt or uncle come and take care of your kids for the weekend. And they let them eat pizza and they let them stay up late and they let them bend all sorts of different rules because they're not going to be there to deal with the consequences down the road. And then you as a parent come back and you have to kind of try and sort things out. And you've got a little bit of a mess on your hand. The people who created the mess for you, even if they were well-meaning in doing it, have moved on. They're not there. And that's kind of how I feel the voters and the citizens of the state of Michigan have been left, because the time horizon is so short, there's no incentive to do anything that's really hard, that requires bipartisan compromise. You can just let things fester a little while longer and ease your way out of office and go on to your next gig. But then we as citizens are like the parents coming home, and we're still coping with the problems. We got cranky, unhappy, tired state government.
It's no wonder that voters get so frustrated with government when it functions like that, it seems like. Marjorie Sarbaugh Thompson and Lyke Thompson are professors of political science at Wayne State University. They wrote the book, Implementing Term Limits, The Case of the Michigan Legislature. Thanks for telling us about your research.
You're welcome.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. So tomorrow is a big day for some people. It's Kentucky Derby.
That's right. The Run for the Roses.
And there's a cocktail that's associated with that and the South overall. What is it?
It's the mint julep.
This is kind of legendary, but I don't think a lot of people, at least in the North, have had a mint julep. Well, how do you make it and why is it so special?
Well, they may have had one, but they probably haven't had a very good one. Even at the Derby, the mint juleps are not known to be particularly good in quality. The mint julep is really a drink that's all about technique, so you really want to pay attention while you're making this drink. The key ingredients, of course, are just mint. I like to use simple syrup. Some people use regular sugar. You can use that. And the most important thing is that you want to muddle those very, very gently. All you're trying to do is bring out the aroma of the mint, and you don't want to crush it up or make it bitter. And we've got a picture on the Michigan Radio website that'll show exactly the right level of muddling you're looking for there.
Let's talk about the actual recipe.
This drink doesn't really have a recipe. It's what you like, how much simple syrup you like, how much mint. I use 2 teaspoons of simple syrup and about the leaves from 1 sprig of mint. And then I'm going to use 2 ounces of bourbon. I chose the Waterhill bourbon from Ann Arbor Distilling Company. This is 100-proof bourbon, and that's nice in a drink like this that has crushed ice, because it means as the drink dilutes, that bourbon flavor is still going to come through.
And crushed ice is an absolute necessary ingredient in it.
Definitely. That is a key part of a mint julep. So to make it, after you've muddled up that mint and the simple syrup, you're going to add your bourbon and then about half fill your glass with crushed ice and stir it until the outside of the glass starts to frost up. And we're using a silver julep cup, as is traditional, but you can use any glass that you like. And then you're going to add some more crushed ice, stir a little bit more, add crushed ice to sort of fill the glass up. And then also really important is to take some mint, a nice big bunch of mint, smack it around in your hand a little bit, because that's going to bring out that aroma. And then you're going to garnish with this beautiful bouquet of mint.
You add a straw, but still you're going to get a nose full of mint.
Absolutely. And the straw is actually meant to be shorter than a standard straw, because that nose full of mint is a key part of the drink. So you're really intended to drink it through the straw, but get your nose right in the mint at the same time.
All right. I'm going to watch you take a sip of this. You tell me whether you did a good job.
Bourbon. Mint.
It's hard to go wrong when it's mixed right, I guess. And it's awfully popular. It's been popular for a long time. This is a pretty old drink.
And I was just researching it, and one of the things I thought was really interesting is this was often thought of as a morning drink. We don't think about morning drinks anymore today, but this was the, you know, get up, have a mint julep, start your day right.
Okay, thanks very much.
Cheers.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's been bobbing his head to the music all day today. Hey, somebody's got to have fun. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Pope Francis has elevated a Michigan priest another step closer to sainthood. The Pope announced that Father Solanus Casey, a member of the Capuchin Franciscan Order of St. Joseph in Detroit and one of the co-founders of the city's Capuchin Soup Kitchen, has been elevated from venerable to blessed by the Roman Catholic Church. Joining us to talk about this is Father Larry Weber. You should assume that a lot of us are not Catholic as you explain what's happening here. So let's start with the announcement. What's the difference between being venerable to being blessed?
In the Roman Catholic tradition, we all want to be saints. We all want to be in heaven with God. So what's happened with the step of beatification means that the church basically makes a pronouncement that there is evidence from God through a sign that has been given that has it goes through a very difficult process of investigation, a miracle, that this soul is in heaven with God. We know that for sure, and that God is pleased with this soul and that this allows this soul to intercede, you know, becomes a helper to others in their relationship with God.
So who was Solanus Casey?
So Solanus Casey was a Capuchin priest, a member of the Franciscan family. He was from Wisconsin originally, and he felt called to the Capuchin way of life. So he came to Detroit, began his Capuchin life here at St. Bonaventure Monastery. He was ordained in a limited way. He was an Irishman. His parents were from Ireland, from an immigrant family. So he was stationed out in New York, wasn't allowed to preach or hear confessions, and they put him on the door as the friar who would answer the door. And people who came to the door suddenly realized the holiness of this man. Eventually, the superiors moved him to Detroit because this is where the superiors were, and they wanted to keep an eye on him. 2 weeks after he came, the front office business had gone from about 20 people a day to about 200. He had this incredible ability to listen to people. He also had an ability to read souls, and he was also known for healings. Tens of thousands visit his tomb here at the Solanus Center.
Which gets us to the performed miracle, the first performed miracle. What was it?
There was this person praying at the tomb here in Detroit, and she had this long list of people she was praying for. She didn't know anything about Father Solanus, by the way. It was her first visit here to the center. Someone had brought her here, and she was asking what all these prayer things were on the tomb. People write out their prayer petitions and leave them on the tomb. And so she started making her list of everyone she was praying for. She was kneeling down, and when she was ready to get up, she heard this inner voice, very strong inner voice, say to her, "But what about you? What do you need?" She had been born with an incurable skin disease. So she prayed for that, and she felt something happening in her body, and within an hour, she was cured of it. Never came back.
What has to happen to elevate Father Casey to sainthood?
We now collect a new favor that has to happen after the Holy Father signed this decree, and it has to go through the same process. So this miracle that was approved was about 5 years ago, because it goes through about five different courts of doctors. So that's what we need for sainthood. But now we just need another favor to be declared by Roma Miracle.
How common is it that someone from the United States becomes a saint?
There are like five women born in the United States who are saints. There are no men born in the United States who are saints. There is the first blessed to be born in the United States, male, is a priest, a diocesan priest from Nebraska, who will be beatified in September. He was a martyr, so he needed no miracle. Father Solanus is the first U.S. male, first to be declared venerable by the Roman Catholic Church. He will be the first U.S.-born male to be beatified who's not a martyr.
That's Father Larry Weber. We've been talking about the Roman Catholic Church elevating Father Solanus Casey, who served in Detroit, to blessed, a step closer to sainthood. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. God bless.